Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
All right, it's Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio, and as I've been reminded many weeks to try out, strap in your cosmic seatbelts, everyone. You are in for paranormal turbulence. My first guest tonight is Al Bielek. He is the survivor of the Philadelphia experiment. I don't really think that I can say much more than that. I want to bring him on the air, and we'll try to clear this up quickly. Al, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, let's jump into this thing as fast as possible, because I don't want to run out of time.
Okay.
Bring our listeners up to speed as far as the Philadelphia experiment and your part.
Okay, the Philadelphia experiment was the name dubbed on a series of tests and long research dealing with invisibility. It was originally called Project Invisibility in the early days, and when it was the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey, from 1934 through the end of the project, as I knew it, back in 1943-44. It was the Navy's attempt, first a private attempt on the part of the Institute, to make an object invisible and eventually a Navy ship invisible. They were completely successful with the first test in 1940 at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It was a small Navy tender. Then they went on to bigger things. It was a battleship. I mean, Tesla, Dr. Nikola Tesla, was the man who was in charge of this project from 1934 to 42. And when he deliberately sabotaged the test with the battleship, he bowed out and Dr. John von Neumann took over. Excuse me. And he decided then to redesign, re-engineer, and do the tests on a ship that was built specifically for these tests, and that was a destroyer escort number 173. And this was later known after its christening as the Eldridge. And there was a series of tests. A lot of work went up into the years developing the theory and developing the hardware. I won't go into all of that. I came on board the project along with my brother Duncan Cameron, because my name then was Edward Cameron. We came on board in 1940, and we were part and parcel of that project through the tests of the Eldridge. We actually ran the equipment on board the Eldridge. There were three tests for the Eldridge. The first one was 22 July 1943. That was fully successful except for the personnel problems. They had full invisibility, radar and optical. There was a second test on the 12th of August, 1943, and that was the one that was a complete disaster because the ship disappeared into hyperspace and came back 4 hours later, somewhat damaged, and the crew was far worse in terms of damage. And there was a third and final test of the Eldridge in October of 43. I was not part of that test. But the basic premise was to manipulate time and do it in a manner which would render the ship, or any object for that matter, invisible. And of course, in the early tests, we were only concerned with optical invisibility. But when radar became a weapon of war, you might say, a tool used then by the military, the Navy, in 1942-43, we had excellent radar, and the Germans did. The object was to make our ships invisible to German radar, so that hopefully we could get merchant ships across the Atlantic along with the Navy escorts.
What I'm going to say to you, Al, is that I think that most of our listeners should spend time and rent the video called The Philadelphia Experiment. How do you feel about that?
That's a good idea. I sort of skipped around on the timing. I didn't do my work until 1958 to complete. And I was, as an engineer in that period of time, fascinated by the story of the Philadelphia Experiment as information became available. Did not know that I was involved. And in 1986, literally my memories of being involved with the Montauk Project came back, but in 1988, they returned one Saturday night in January that I was involved in the Philadelphia Experiment, watching the same movie, the commercial version of the Philadelphia Experiment, late one Saturday night on HBO. And it hit me like a bomb, and I knew I was involved, but it took some time before the details came back. It doesn't all come back as one massive mirage of memory. It comes back in pieces. I knew then I was involved, and I started to do a lot of research, and of course I found that the more I dug, the more involved I was, and also that there were other people around and survivors who remembered me. There were, in fact, quite a number. A good number of them now are dead, but there are still a few alive. And that basically is the story there without a lot of detail.
So now the thing is that why I find this interesting is that according to the times that we've done interviews, one of the things that you talked about was the fact that you were placed in the middle of a circle by the Navy.
MPs.
Okay, the MPs. And then through the help of extraterrestrial, I don't know how to say this, but...
Well, the hardware from Montauk in 83, which was built by us, but was designed in part by extraterrestrials who were part of the Montauk Project. And equipment could focus anywhere in space or time as they chose. And they picked me up. It was all planned from the 83 end. They picked me up from 1947, pulled me to 83, and gave me the Royal Works, if you want to put it that way. Only after a long period of time, and only in the last few years, that I remember the details of that final episode at Montauk before I lost my identity as Edward Cameron and became Al Bielek. And I do remember some of the details of the equipment. I've since had it verified by someone whose name I can't use, who is alive today and has been deeply buried in the interior, that age regression equipment was not built by our government, nor was it extraterrestrial. It said it was resurrected equipment from an old civilization, probably Atlantis. In case your real readers and listeners don't know it, our government has been all over the world digging up these ancient sites of artifacts where they have found still functioning technological equipment from other civilizations. I did learn a great deal over a period of years as to what had happened to me, what was involved, and the fact that this was all part of a, well, you might call it a conspiracy. The idea of keeping certain people who knew too much silent, as you mentioned, was quite true. I had learned a great deal, and I guess I talked too much, and they decided I had to be shut up but not killed.
So the point is that you were put back into another...
Family,
another life, another time, and your brother, though, and here we have a couple of minutes before we have to take our half-hour break. Let's talk about your brother.
Okay.
Duncan was put. Okay, go ahead, you tell him.
Okay, Duncan went back to the future, back to the 82-83 period. I do not know exactly where. He worked there for a while, and an accident occurred where he started to age very, very rapidly, at the rate of about a year an hour. And they couldn't control it. Even though they had age regression equipment available, they could not control it and slow it down very much. And because of the fact that they had complete control of time, they went back to my father and Duncan's father back in the late 40s with a message, get busy, make another kid, and his son's dying. We can't afford to have him die. So we remarried his fifth wife. And First, there was a girl who was present Duncan's sister, and then Duncan was born in 1951. And he grew up himself not knowing anything of his real past.
Now, people need to know that he was actually a walk into another body, is that right?
Yes, he was. That is correct. The kid was born, but he walked in at a later time, 1963.
All right, let's just talk real fast. A walk-in means that he left the body that was aging very quickly.
Right, and went into a younger, newer body, but by the same father, and therefore the same name.
All right.
And he knew nothing until under hypnosis back in late 86, or actually late 87. He knew nothing of the Philadelphia experimenter's involvement. He went back to the age of 12 because he had a lot of traumatic problems from Montauk. And he was asked to go back earlier, so he winds up in the hypnotic situation, back on the decks of the Eldridge, recognizes it as the Eldridge, and says, well, there's people here I know. One of them is the guy I know is Al Bielek today. And he had no prior history or knowledge of the Philadelphia experiment, never read a thing, never saw the movie, and under hypnosis verified his connection and the fact that he was there himself. So he became aware of it, and of course he's recovered much more memory himself since. But that's the way he recovered it. I did by watching the movie, and it was ready to surface anyway.
All right, there's two things we want to talk about absolutely when we come back. One of them is we want to talk about Montauk.
Yes.
And I know this is kind of, it's hard to put all this stuff together, but my goodness, you and I have talked sometimes as long as 2 and 3 hours and still can't get this thing to come out as well. That's why I like people to get that video, because it's got now 3 or 4 different, three times that you spoke different places. We're talking about a difficult subject. Mostly we're going to talk about time travel, but we're just kind of giving some ideas here. we need to kind of maybe back up for 1 second here and talk a little bit about time, because I think that is probably going to be at least 90% of the problem of what we talk about here.
True enough.
Let's see. My understanding, first of all, is that time is not linear. Is that correct?
And normally it is linear in terms of what we normally observe. And, of course, a clock measures it, indicates a linear time flow, but it can be altered. It is possible to change this. The Russians have done a lot of research on this and have published on it openly that time normally is linear, but it can be compressed or expanded, and it can be changed to run from anywhere from t equals zero to t equals infinity, which means the time flow can be almost stopped or it can be run up to an almost infinite speed, depending on certain external conditions. And one of those external conditions was the explosion of a hydrogen bomb, which where they found this out first. Normally, it is linear, but it can be manipulated, and it can be manipulated in a small area. And this is the basis of what they did, the Philadelphia experiment. If you, inside of a small area, change the rate of time flow, you can then cause an object, if you want, to travel through time forward or backwards, or you can move it in terms of phase. If those who understand electrical engineering know that you can have a phase shift in voltage or in current, and they can either be in phase or out of phase. But in any case, you do a phase shift, and you change certain aspects of that voltage wave. Now, in time, you also have waves. And this is, of course, not readily understood, but time has a wave function, and you can ride, as we normally do, in a specific area, what we call the basic timeline, which humanity and our planet is on. If you shift phase-wise 90 degrees, you're out of this reality. If you go partway, an object becomes invisible. And that was what we were doing in the Eldridge, and what can be done and has been done since. There are now undoubtedly other techniques than that for making an object invisible, but I'm talking about what we did back then.
Right. Okay, now we've kind of touched on a few things. This idea of a walk-in, maybe we should just clear that up real quickly. A walk-in, the way that Duncan did it, of course, is kind of a special case, but
yes.
Walk-ins...
Basically, a walk-in is a soul that comes into a body that's already living. And either the native soul gets kicked out or pushed out, or in some cases you have dual occupancy, which becomes psychologically confusing and also can lead to this dual personality problem and psychosis. In the case of Duncan, his real soul came into that body age 12, and the personality that was there left, and this was arranged in advance, so there was no problem. The aliens arranged this very nicely, and of course, in the 80s, the government has a good handle on this kind of technology, and from the 80s onward. But this was originally an alien-type manipulation because they knew, as well as the government, that there were two key people involved in this project, and I believe now there was more, who had to be kept alive until at least the year 2003, until this whole time rift problem created by the lockup of the two experiments stabilized.
Okay, let's talk about the two experiments. In 1943, was it?
Yes.
We have the Philadelphia experiment. What was happening at the same point where the time came together? What was the other experiment?
The other experiment was the Montauk Project.
Okay.
In 1983.
All right. And let's tell our listeners why that particular drop-dead date was picked. It had to do with the fact that the Earth, as I remember, as you told me once, has its own...
its own biorhythms. Okay. And they all peak out at one specific time, and that happens to be the 12th of August, 1943, 63, 83, every 20 years on the 12th of August, plus or minus half a day approximately. And that date for the 12th of August was dictated from the future, because in 43 nobody knew anything about biorhythms of the planetary body called Earth. But it was important because the only way they would get the two experiments to lock up, which was deliberate from the future, was by picking the correct date in 43, and that's why von Neumann was given a drop-dead date for the second test. They told him, literally, you complete the test by 12 August 1943 or forget it. Well, he knew his nature, and they knew that he would take this all the time he possibly could, and they would hold it off until the 12th of August.
Now, you told me once a few years ago that this entire thing was actually a charade that was planned by... a group of extraterrestrials, so that they could actually have a mass invasion.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Yes, it was a mass invasion planned, and it took place because the large ships, not the small ones, have been leaking through for perhaps eons of time in very small numbers. The large ships were not able to by themselves manipulate through space-time and bring in large numbers of aliens, but with this hole, if you will, this rift in space-time, it was very easy for them to maneuver through for another time frame reference or another reality into our universe, land as they did at Edwards Air Force Base, and perhaps Holloman also, in 1953-54, with the big landing being in 54, plus massive overflights of Roswell and other parts of New Mexico from 47 onward, and literally tell the government, here we are, what are you going to do about it? We want this, this, and this, and the president at that time being Dwight Eisenhower was told by his military and civilian advisors, make some kind of a treaty with these guys. We don't know their technology. That's far beyond us. We want to buy time to find out what's going on.
So the point was that the reason that, everything, I mean, from this, just this idea that we're talking about,
yeah.
One of the reasons that we have kept quiet, or why the government has kept quiet about our knowledge of extraterrestrials, is because, frankly, there's nothing we can do, and we're just happy that they haven't just literally taken over. Is that right?
Right. Today we have our own technology, which is far more advanced than it was in the 40s and the 50s, and we have means of fighting back, but even so, we don't have the technology that some of these alien groups have. Now, a lot of people dispute the alien aspect, and of course, in Project Blue Book, the civilian version, they said, well, there's no evidence of aliens, it's mistaken identity of objects which are natural to our atmosphere, and so forth. Government has very adequate proof. They have had it all along. There are pictures available. I know people have seen the private government files with high clearance. And the evidence is all there, but they don't want the public to know the fact that, A, they made an agreement, and, B, they made a bad agreement. And you don't know what's going to really happen in the, shall we say, the end of this, because they're trying to find still a way out, and now we're faced with other problems. And the government has made some attempts to solve the alien problem, but they've not really been that successful at it. Now, there are, of course, friendly aliens, but the agreements they made were not with the friendly ones. They were those who demanded certain things, and we had to buy it, in essence. And they hoped they would find a solution. They have not found that solution yet.
All right. Now, let's just touch a little bit on Montauk. What actually was going on there? And you told me that Duncan was very important.
Yes.
In the Montauk project. I'll probably have to cut you off somewhere in the middle of talking about it, but let's start it at least.
Okay. He was an important part of Montauk project because he had certain abilities, psychic abilities, you might say. And when the project went through its various phases and they wound up finding the computers would not control this thing alone, they had to use, you might say, a psychic who had been trained in virtual reality special training, which meant that that person was trained through the VIR program at Chesapeake Bay to think in terms of symbolic logic, and would come out, be picked up by the computer links, the RF links, if you will, and it would be converted immediately into a language which the computer understood. Therefore, one of the trained psychics, Duncan being one of them, and there were others, could sit down in this chair, which would pick up their thoughts and their ideas in the proper state. They would be pre-instructed what they wanted to do. They would think about it. It would be converted to a symbolic logic. The computers would read this, and then they would do the rest of the manipulation in terms of the stored programs and the stored knowledge and algorithms they had to manipulate the time portal to do what was desired. In other words, go to some particular time or some particular location or both. Duncan was probably the best one they had. There were other substitutes which were used, but he had to be trained for it. They couldn't just take a psychic off the street. They all had to go through very special training.
Now tell me one thing. In the 4-hour video, do you talk at all about Montauk?
Very little. This one, I do touch on it, but primarily it is on the Philadelphia experiment, the background of the scientists involved, my family and my connections, and of course the questions and the mathematics are involved, which is generalized. It's not completely specific. And one other aspect, the development of the transistor and the fact that much of the transistors, the modern ones that we use, were developed by aliens in conjunction with a certain organization on Long Island.
You speak about the transistor. Now, a lot of people probably have never thought of this. I know that I never thought about it until you mentioned it the last time. But all of a sudden, from tubes to transistors, and you say, what happened?
Yes. What happened is a long story, but very briefly, there was a problem, apparently, with one of the alien groups. They had transistor-like devices on board their ship that were failing. They couldn't go back home to get replacements, so they approached our government and says, we'll show you how to make these devices if you'll make them for us. And you'll have to set up the processing equipment, the machinery, but we'll show you how to do it. We'll come in until you know how to make them. We'll want a certain number of them. After that, you can do whatever you want with them. So they did produce these things. They were called the surface barrier transistor. They're a very special breed. They were very common in the 50s and the 60s, and they were sold under various trade names by Sprague and by Philco as the MADT or whatever. But they originated in Long Island, and large numbers were made under government contract, and they were pulled from the market. But they kept making them for the government until about 1970-71. Millions were made. We don't really know how many.
Now, what was so special about these transistors?
What was so special about them was the doping. They used some very rare and exotic metals and elements beyond uranium. Some of the materials were supplied by aliens, and they had the capability of amplifying signals in a way which gave you more out than what came in if they were used properly. They did various strange processing techniques. They would handle the etheric components of energy, the higher order components. The ordinary transistor will not, the silicons will not do it. Some of the older germaniums would, and these were originally germanium devices, but very specially processed. So they had very odd and strange characteristics, which are being rediscovered today by some people who have gotten their hands on them. But the production ended in 71, 72, and how many were built, we don't know, and who used them all, we don't know either. But it set the pace for the modern transistor, because the earliest devices introduced by Marbell, that is AT&T, were junction-type devices with whiskers, and they were alloy types. They simply didn't work well at all. The first breakthrough of a good transistor was a surface barrier type, and from that point on, our physics geniuses developed a whole new series of devices and went to silicon. And, of course, the history of the silicon device and integrated circuits now is well known. But the earliest history is not well known. And that's what I just told you about.
Right. Now, we touched on John von Neumann. A lot of people should hear this because I always found this very interesting. People do not realize that, or maybe know his name, because he is the person who generally is thought of when we think of computers.
Yes.
Why don't you just explain real quickly how he figured in the Philadelphia experiment?
Well, he was the second director of the project from 42 on. He was already at the Institute. I'd been there from 1933. And he was a mathematical genius, but he also was something of an engineer and knew how to convert mathematics into hardware, a very rare ability for a mathematician. He was in charge of the project. He worked with other scientists and engineers there and helped to rearrange the hardware, so to speak, into the new format of a pulsed system, following generally Tesla's outlines. But after he was finished with that project and he realized the serious problems, because he knew there was a serious problem between test one and two, but he was not given time enough to try and correct it, he eventually solved the problem between 1947, when he was asked to reopen the whole project, and 1953-54, when he developed the computer in 52, which was part of the answer. And the other approaches I don't know, but he solved the whole problem of the personnel reaction, so that today there is no personnel problem. He solved that.
You're talking about the personnel problem in invisibility, is that correct?
Yes, correct. And today there are small personal invisibility units as well as very large units for entire ships, including carriers now.
Now, you say the stealth program is all based basically on this original information?
Yes, it is. Even though it's gone through many generations of change, it is based on the original work that goes back to the days of 43 in the Philadelphia experiment. That is the grandfather, you might say, the genre of all of these newer systems and much technology which has come since. Research which was started first in Germany during World War II, then afterwards at Brookhaven National Laboratories, then through various other projects, too lengthy to detail here, which involved mind control, first using chemical hypnosis means, then the Reichian techniques, then they went to electronic. And Montauk was, you might say, a bed for many research projects, not only the time-space travel, but there were some indications there that they might have been involved in genetic research. There definitely was a lot of work going on mind control, particularly in terms of the Montauk boys, setting them up and programming them for future use. And it wasn't just at Montauk, many other locations, hundreds of thousands of them we know now, on several locations, many locations in the country.
These are boys that were actually programmed to do certain things, which
yes,
almost like
on command.
Almost like from the boys from Brazil, right?
Yeah. That's any of these programs. The Manchurian Candidate is a perfect example, except that was an older man. This type of thing, but they programmed them at an early age, anywhere from 12 to 16, typically, maybe 12 to 17. And some girls are involved in this also, but not at Montauk. These programs constitute a huge secret army of, you might say, reserve power for use by push-button control. Crank them on, they are pre-programmed to do whatever they're told to do, and who knows what it may be, but I think one can use their imagination knowing the way our intelligence agencies and certain sectors
right.
of the government operate.
Al Bielek, we're out of time.
Okay.
I really apologize. Thank you so much for being on the show. We will do this again.